everyone. This is Marty Oakley of the PPJ Gazette. And this, of course, is the Sunday night edition of TS Radio, where we talk about guardianship abuse. Joining me this week as co-host is Linda Kincaid, who has helped put most of these programs together, line up these guests. And so I want to thank her for that. And welcome to the show, Linda.
Thank you, Marty.
We're going to have a very special man on here shortly, Dr. Robert Fettgather. He'll be joining us in just a few minutes. In the interim, is there any update, Linda, on Gisella Reardon?
There is a possibility that her son may be able to negotiate to have limited visitation. He has scheduled mediation with the public guardian tomorrow afternoon. However, they will not allow him to bring anyone else. This is going to be behind closed doors. He cannot bring an attorney, an advocate, a witness of any sort. It's going to be Marcus Reardon against whatever the public guardian chooses to throw at him.
You know, you had made a very astute observation last week that these people are treated worse than prisoners. Prisoners in federal prisons have more rights than these people do. And if you tried to prevent them from having a visitor, the whole federal government would come down on you. And yet this is done to these elderly people. And in the instance of tonight, with Dr. Fettgather's son, with disabled and vulnerable adults. And I don't know how they get away with this. How do they get away with this, Linda?
By keeping it in the dark. As you said, prisoners are allowed visitors. You can go on to the Santa Clara County website, and online you can schedule a visit with a person who is in the Santa Clara County jail. But there is no way you can schedule a visit with someone who is a conservatee.
That is just, Linda, it's like I told you, we have got to figure out a way. There has got to be a way to get this out into the front of the public so that everybody knows that not only that this is going on, but that it could happen to them. At the drop of the hat, it could happen to them. And I guess issues like this for most people aren't important because they haven't been victimized by it, either by becoming a prisoner in one of these places, and this is what it amounts to. And you know, we talked last week also, Linda, about the fact that this is a recognized form of torture. This is one of the means of torture that was argued in front of the Supreme Court was extreme isolation from not only your community, but your family, from close associates, from everything you know. This is a recognized form of torture that is being perpetrated. Go ahead.
It is propagated through the court system as well. Just the last couple of days, I've been going through documents prepared by my mother's court-appointed attorney. He's just submitted a bill to my mother's estate, payment for his services, which I consider quite inappropriate because reading through his documents, he has clearly identified that my mother was an abuse victim, and document after document, he signs under penalty of perjury that my mother was isolated. She was prevented from having visitors. He mentions other things that would be considered inappropriate or abusive, like having her bed on the floor. My mother slept on the floor for over a year. And then he concludes that there has been no abuse. There is no evidence of abuse, that she's being perfectly well cared for at the facility. And these are in my mother's court file. This is presented to the court, and most likely the judge only reads the conclusion that everything is fine and doesn't read the other 6 or 7 pages where it documents that my mother was not allowed visitors for extended periods of time, but that likely will never even be read by the judge. He will read the summary and move on.
There's so much going wrong in this country right now, and I work with so many different issues, but prevalent in every one of them is this corruption of the courts and this movement of the courts towards basically just doing whatever's convenient for them. The law means nothing. Legal instruments mean nothing. Previous agreements mean nothing. It's whatever that court wants to do at the time. And I, when I had Clear the Bench Colorado, the group from Clear the Bench Colorado on, one of the things they talked about extensively was the fact that the courts are just absolutely, they're running outside the law. And that you're basically just, you're taking your life in your hands to step into any courtroom of any kind in this country, because none of them abide by the law. If the law doesn't suit the current situation, they throw it out. They ignore it.
It's at every level. You know, there are a lot of people who are very angry about judges not upholding the law. In my mind and from my experiences, the judges are really at the end of the road in these situations. They don't see even the tip of the iceberg of what's going on. You know, I see the deputy public guardians who are behaving extremely abusively, and then the public guardian who oversees them is ignoring what's going on, and then the board of supervisors for the county does not hold the public guardian accountable. Then in the court system itself, we have the court-appointed investigator who is there to investigate these cases and bring any concerns to the attention of the court. They don't do that. They write these reports that make everything sound like the public guardian or whoever is appointed is perfect. Anyone who is questioning it is painted as creating disturbances or somehow is villainized. Then we have the court-appointed attorneys who bill tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars to estates, in essence to fight the families who are trying to protect their loved ones. And this would be the case whether it's an elder, as in my case, or whether it's a child, as in Dr. Bob's case. When you try to bring these issues to the attention of the court, and the only way to do this is to file a motion, you then find the court-appointed attorney filing an opposing motion. You find the court-appointed investigator filing a report that says the ward is being well cared for and this family is trying to interfere in that care. So you end up getting charged to try to protect your loved one and getting charged for the may I call them criminals, to oppose you in trying to care for your loved one. And what actually gets before the judge is just a few smatterings that are very painted in favor of the system that's in place, the guardianship system. And the judge actually hears very little of the evidence that the family is trying to put forward. I mean, we have mountains, days and days of depositions, thousands of pages of documents that show that what I have told the court and the press about my mother's case is correct. We are backing that up with testimony under oath. Will the judge ever see much of that? Likely very little of it. When we get to trial, it'll be minimum 2.5 years after this all started, and we will have just a few hours to try to get all of this before the judge. And while you're doing this, the other side is objecting to everything you say. So the judge himself will be exposed to very little of what actually happened. So whether he makes a decision in our favor or not, he will never know the full story.
You know, I've been doing shows on a totally unrelated topic, but it's on the rounding up and slaughtering of our wild horse herds out west. And one of the ladies I had on the show has waged a 20-year battle with the Bureau of Land Management. In fact, she was so fierce in her battle with them and the laws they were breaking that it resulted in what's called an administrative court, a special court set up within the Department of Interior to deal with these types of complaints. And they operate the same way these probate courts do. If the evidence brought in isn't conducive to the state's case, they throw it out. And it's they who decide what is evidence and what isn't. And regardless of what you bring in there, the judge at his discretion can arbitrarily throw it aside. He can throw aside the law, and they do routinely. And she remarked, she said, it's like going into a circus because you're lucky if you get to speak at all. And if you do, she said, just what you did. She said, the attorney for the opposing side is running his mouth nonstop. And she said, and the worst part of it is, we're paying for him to do that.
Yes,
and
we are paying for that.
And that's the same thing in probate. You are paying for these court-appointed attorneys. Even though they're tapping the estate, they also get paid for being a court-appointed attorney. They're paid with taxpayer money.
That's
so
correct.
They're double-dipping.
Yeah, the court-appointed attorney is paid through my tax dollars, and he's paid again through billing my mother's estate. And he is paying to fight me while I am trying to get decent care for my mother. And he claims to be representing my mother.
Well, and virtually everyone I've talked to in these cases, it's never been a matter of the estate. I mean, there's been one or two where obviously that is the crux of their interest. But for the most part, most people, if you just gave them back their family member and left them alone, left them in peace, you could go ahead and take everything. But these people just seem to be determined to put these individuals through hell while they steal everything they've got. And
there's
I don't understand
that. To me, it seemed there was no reason to lock up my mother and not let her have visitors, to make her sleep on the floor, to not let her have decent medical care. You know, I cannot see any rationale for not letting my mother go out to a doctor and be appropriately treated for medical conditions. And that's a completely separate issue from stealing the estate. You know, yes, of course I would like to recover the estate, but what they have done to my mother is just inhumane.
Well, it's like I said, Linda, they are using forms of recognized torture. And we've seen the country rise up in opposition to what we have done to these people held at Gitmo that have been there now for 10 years or more, that have never been charged with a crime, same as the elderly, mm-hmm. have never committed a crime that anybody knows of, same as the elderly. But if you tried to isolate them, the whole country screaming, that's not right, that's not right. But we can take grandma and stick her in one of these places, loot her estate, drug her up, mistreat her, and people say, oh, well, you know, what are you going to do? What are you going to do?
And that does seem to be the attitude. You know, they're old, they're going to die anyway, what's the problem? But
exactly.
When it's your mom or when it's your grandmother, it doesn't seem so distant anymore. All of a sudden, it's somebody you care about, and you're watching them being mistreated, and it takes on a very different flavor when it's someone that's in your family and you're close to.
I don't think there's anything worse than someone having total and absolute control of someone you love, and they're at their mercy, and you can't do a damn thing to help them.
Yeah, I thought we had abolished slavery in this country.
Yeah. Well, this is human trafficking. It's what it gets down to. Human trafficking used to mean, you know, being sold for sex. But anymore, you can be an elderly person with assets, or you can have an increased value in the Medicare Medicaid system that can be tapped into. You can be a child that's in foster care, and as a ward of the state, you don't exist, you don't have any rights. You can be leased out to pharmaceutical companies and even killed, and not much is going to happen to you. And this is, I don't understand what's happening here. It's like we have all been commodified. We've all been turned into commodities that are bought and sold and traded. When I was talking to Dr. Fettgather earlier this week, one of the things I told him was, I said, it's like we're all for sale now. People don't look at us, these people at the top that are orchestrating all of this, don't look at the rest of us out here and think, geez, you know, there's a lot of people out there that are looking at how much is that one worth? Under what system, what program can I put money off of that person? And it's like a whole system is in place to buy, sell, and trade. We have been commodified. And this refusal, especially of the federal government, I came across, someone had said, oh, they passed a law in 2009, and it's going to fix all of this. And that was thanks to Herb Kohl, because, you know, I'm just no fan of Herb Kohl's. He's the head of the Committee on Aging. Thank God he's retiring this year. And I have sent some scathing letters to Mr. Cole. But anyway, in 2009, they passed the Elder Justice Act. And I thought, well, geez, I must have missed something here. So I pulled that bill up and ran the whole thing off and sat here for 3 days going through it. All it was an expansion of the power of Adult Protective Services and the right of the state to intervene in emergency situations. And then they doled out $11.5 million to state agencies to expand their size and scope and reach. And this was the Elder Justice Act. There was not a damn word in there about protecting these people from predatory guardians. There was not a stinking word in there about reining in these corrupt probate judges or limiting the access of attorneys to file motions into the case. There was nothing in there to force the auditing. I think they're in Santa Clara County, if I remember correctly, from that video your friend put together, which we'll be putting up on PPJ. $72.5 million in Santa Clara County unaccounted for in probate cases.
Correct. That's from a 2010 audit.
$72.5 million looted from people who were unfortunate enough to be caught up in this mess.
And that was the cash. You know, there are also in that audit, it was many pages and many items, and it was a very scathing audit. You know, you're talking about the $75 million in cash that is unaccounted for or misplaced. There is also the personal property of the conservatees. The audit explained how the objects, the valuables from a conservatee's home are taken and placed into storage, and there has never yet in all the years been an accounting of those items.
Jiminy Christmas.
Things just disappear. A friend of a friend had a parent went through this system, and fortunately he did not go through the personal abuse. His parents did not go through the personal abuse that I'm seeing in some of the others, but he talked about how individuals from the public guardian's office went into his parents' home to clean things out. And original artwork was just thrown away. They didn't recognize it as being valuable, and it was simply thrown away. There was no respect for the family's property or the things the family would value and care for.
And that's something else I'm trying to figure out here, Linda. Okay, so you loot the assets in the sense of the actual property, investments, savings, whatever it is. Why would they give these people access to dispose of the personal possessions of these people, and especially if they don't assign any value to it? Why should they be allowed to dispose of personal possessions?
Does it sound like there might be some motivation here?
Yeah. You steal this person's life from them, you hold them prisoner, you medicate them against their will, you isolate them from everyone they know, you begin looting their estate, and then just to put the cap on everything, you take everything that was near and dear to them and get rid of it. Well, that ought to fix it.
Yeah. And Ian, who was on a few weeks ago, showed me the appraisal of his parents' personal property, and items such as refrigerators, things we would think of as fairly big-ticket items, were assigned values of just a few dollars. I believe his father's pickup truck was assigned a value of $200.
Oh, and I suppose all of that was some well-meaning friends took all that off their hands for him.
Yeah, I don't know what happened to the items. I just saw the appraisal when we were looking through his file, and the pricing, the values assigned were completely unrealistic. You know, it sounded like quite a nice truck. I'd be very pleased to have a truck like that for $200.
Jiminy Christmas.
Maybe I can get a new refrigerator for $2.
Yeah, I'd like to. I need one. said so far I can't find one used for less than $250. And yeah, I should be so lucky to stumble onto one of these. But see, that I don't understand at all. And why should you be allowed to dispose of someone's personal items?
They take control of everything. They take control of the person and the person's life. And
well,
if you fight it in court, then you end up paying for both sides of the battle.
God. I just don't know what kind of person it would take to do something like this. I don't know how you walk around and face other people. I don't know how you face yourself. I had called, of course, in the course of all of this over the last year and a half, I've called several senators, representatives, this one, that one, something else. And, of course, you get shuffled around as somebody's staff worker. And they just, without exception, Linda, why they had no idea such a thing was going on, why this must be an isolated event, why they never heard of such a thing, and blah, 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 blah. And I finally blew up with Al Franken's office here in Minnesota. He has an aide in his office, a staffer named Lisbeth, and me and Lisbeth have tangled before over smart meters. And I had called her about this situation, and I said, I'd called his office, got routed to her again. I think they know my number by now. And she said, what do you want today? And I said, I'll tell you, Elizabeth. I said, we've got this issue of guardianship abuse that's just rampant across the country. And she went, she goes, another one of those non-issues? I said, well, apparently somebody thinks it's important because the GAO has done a report on it for 11 years now. And the Committee on Aging, headed by another Democrat, Herb Cole, I said, it's held how many meetings that he snoozed through? I said, where he had people come in and testify. I said, according to the GAO, I said, somewhere around 6 million on average, just in a handful of cases they look at, is taken every day from people that have been kidnapped, held in these institutions. And I would like to know what Senator Franken's position is or thoughts are on this. And she just sat there and she goes, she said, where do you come up with this stuff? And I said, I'm trying to figure out how you couldn't know.
Your numbers when the GAO report, I would speculate that those numbers are actually very low. From meeting other victims' families, by far the majority do not go public.
Yeah, exactly. And GAO even says that there are just thousands of cases, but they only look at 10 or 12 across 5 or 6 states.
Mm-hmm.
They just look at it a minuscule. They pick out the ones that they can actually do in depth. And this is what they – so over 10 or 12 cases – across 5 or 6 states, and one of the things I'm hoping Dr. Fettgather calls in here shortly. He was supposed to have called here about 10 minutes ago, and I've sent him an email, so hopefully he'll catch up with us. What I'm trying to figure out is how this could happen state to state, and I still maintain that this is coming from someplace higher up. This whole system was put in place. People were trained or advised on how to do this because this surfaced at the same time that these administrative courts, family courts, and probate courts were set up as an offshoot of state courts who supposedly were so overloaded on their docket they just couldn't deal with these things anymore. And all of these people called judges are actually just appointed, and they can be somebody's brother-in-law or sister or, some guy they found on the corner. And they don't have to have any legal training or background. They don't have to have any previous experience. It's an appointed position. You can't get rid of them because you didn't put them there. And these courts, this whole issue ballooned when they created these administrative courts, when they created the family courts, the probate courts.
It's so easy for this to happen. I'm most familiar with California law, of course, because that's where I'm dealing with the issue. But as I talk to other people, it really sounds like the probate laws are pretty similar from state to state. And it is just so amazingly easy to do this sort of thing. You know, I look around my own neighborhood, and I could easily come up with half a dozen people that I could do the same thing to if I were so inclined. Now that I know how it works, it would be very, very easy. All you do is make a few accusations against the family, say, oh, the lady across the street is being neglected by her daughter, she's had a few falls, she's really not doing so well anymore. I've been a friend of hers for many, many years. I care about her more than her daughter, who doesn't bother to come see her. Well, I'm going to file a petition for conservatorship. And because I care about her so much, I'm also going to take over her assets and take care of her estate for her. And while I'm at it, I might even get her to sign a new will and a new trust that puts me in charge, because she appreciates all that I've done for her over the years. And by the time
I'm at it, I'll buy me a new Cadillac and a new house. And go ahead, Linda. I'm sorry.
Well, I need the new Cadillac so that I can drive across the street to go see her. And by the time her daughter figures out what has happened, I would be appointed. I would be in control. And the daughter would now be scrambling, trying to find some attorney who's willing to take this on and fight me against it. But once I've become conservator, I can now use the little old lady's estate to fight the daughter, who is now trying to disrupt what I have set in place for the benefit of the conservatee. And it really is quite easy to do. I watched it happen with my mother. A step-granddaughter came in, took control, made a few accusations, filed a couple of petitions. And next thing I knew, she was in charge. And for the last 2 years, I've been fighting, trying to undo what she did.
I will tell you, right next door to me, there is an older couple in their late 80s that live right next door to me. And here this last winter, she had gotten sick, was in the hospital. Her doctor was a doctor I saw one time, and I nearly blacked this woman's eyes and took her hair off her head. Not that I have a bad temper or anything, but so anyway, this lady, well, it turns out coincidentally that this older couple next door also owns a big, huge farm sitting out here in the country that this doctor and her husband were buying from this older couple on contract for deed. She, like I say, the lady gets sick, she's in the hospital. She never came home. The doctor went and got an emergency petition for guardianship. And she's now up here in the nursing home. And the husband of the doctor comes to visit about every 2 to 3 days with a big fifth of J&B brandy. And he walks out of the house with various things under his arm. I suspect they're antiques. And so the husband went the one day up here to the nursing home to get his wife and bring her home for the day, which he's allowed to do 4 times a week. He can bring her home for the day. And the public guardian, it's not the public guardian, it's friend of the court, something like that, shows up and advises him that he can't see her, that until further notice, the doctor who has the guardianship says he can't see her, that it's not good for her. So I'm standing in my yard, I can hear all of this, right? And being the introverted person that I am, mild-mannered, I trotted my fat, fluffy butt right up across the yard and said, excuse me, did you just tell this man he can't see his wife? She said, it's for her own good. And I said, I would advise against that. And she goes, we're doing what's best for her. And I said, I know you don't know me and you've never heard of me. But I said, my name is Marty Oakley. And I said, I have an internet radio show and we address guardianship abuse and the crap that people do to elderly people. And I said, you know, I said, I think I'm going to have to get on air and talk about the fact that the same people that owe this man money for this big, huge farm out here on a contract for deed are the same ones who kidnapped his wife and against her will put her up here in this nursing home, and the same ones using you that are now trying to deny him access to her. And I said, could you write down your name for me? And she said, for what? I said, because I love to call names on air. I want to know who you are. And so anyway, of course she didn't. She jumped in her truck. And so I stood out there and got her tag number. And I said, that's fine. I said, got your tag number. That's okay. And she's pulling away. So I told him, I said, you get in your car, you go up to that nursing home, and you go get your wife. And he goes, well, I don't know if they'll let me. I said, you just go up there and get her. He went up there. He was back 10 minutes later with her.
Oh, right.
They never said a word, never said anything, and I haven't seen the husband back over here. But this goes on all the time. And if you think this can't happen, like I say, this is right in the house right next to me. Right next to me.
Yeah,
and
so
if it had not been... Well, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't need to show you documents to prove that it really can happen because you watched it happen right next door to you. And
exactly.
And this can happen to anyone. This is not just the elderly. This is not just children who are born disabled. A friend of mine was in a fairly serious traffic accident right before Thanksgiving last year, just to show that it can happen to anyone at any age. And he was not driving crazy, at least not that day he wasn't. He was stopped at a red light, and a car hit him going about 50 miles an hour. You know, he was stopped. He got rear-ended, got pushed into the car in front of him, had a concussion, and for a number of months, we were really quite concerned whether he would be able to function normally again. He is recovering function fairly well now, but I think that's an example of what could happen to anyone. You fall off a ladder, you hit your head, you're driving down the street, you get rear-ended. This could be anyone. And once you are slightly impaired, here they come. The vultures come in and they just sew up everything. And next thing you know, you have nothing left. You don't have any assets to fight for yourself. You may not even have contact with the outside world to be able to ask for help. When my mother called me begging me for help, they took her cell phone away to keep her from calling me. They decided that it was not good for her to talk to me because it upset her. She was calling me begging for help. So in her own interest, in order to protect her from me upsetting her, they took her phone away. So for over a year, she wasn't allowed to ask for help.
This is so disgusting. Elaine just brought up in the chat room, of course, the Gary Harvey case out there in New York, where you got the attorneys representing the guardian, acting as guardian, representing the hospital, representing absolutely everybody involved, including representing supposedly her husband, and all of them, including the judge sitting on the case, tied to the same law firm. If that's not a conflict of interest. And yet here they've held that man prisoner for more than 2 years now, I think three, going on 3 years, tapping her insurance close to $1 million a year for this man's care. At one point, I can't remember how many hundreds of thousands they had charged for physical therapy, of which he got none. But they had these bills. I'm waiting to hear back from Dr. Fettgather. I've tried to contact him here. Like I said, I was hoping he would be on with us by now, and he is running late, and I hope nothing has gone wrong there. But you look at his case and the declaring of people incompetent to take care of their own relative, their own child, their own mother, their own father, whatever. We have that case of Dr. Clark there in California, that when I heard his case and saw this man's credentials, Linda, he had been a four-time U.S. ambassador. He'd been with the Air Force. He'd been with the Army. He had taught international law. He'd been with NASA. I mean, this man has more PhD degrees than anybody I ever saw in my life. And his sister had become incapacitated, had a sizable estate. He was the trustee. They tried to take an emergency petition for guardianship, said he was incompetent. This man that is even now working with the federal government tried to declare him incompetent to handle her estate. And he showed the court where he had never taken anything from that estate other than what was needed for her care. Not one dime. And they fought him and fought him. And he represented himself, of course, having such an extensive background in the law, he was quite capable of doing so. He fought them tooth and nail. He won. And then he turned around and he sued the state for legal fees. And they said he's not entitled to them because he wasn't an attorney. Well, you did the work of an attorney, and you had to file all those filing fees, and you had to set up those papers like an attorney would. I think you did legal work. You should get paid for it. And he said, I don't need the money. It isn't the matter of the money. He said, but they made me work as an attorney, because he said I could not get an attorney that would represent me.
And oh, he it said is a lot of them, extremely difficult to get an attorney to take a case. These cases are... Well, there are the attorneys that I say are no better than the rest, you know, the part of the vulture system, but it's extremely difficult to find a good attorney because it's very difficult to win these cases.
Well, you know, there's been many cases, Jonelle Grace out there in Washington, fighting that case out there. She won, eventually, she won. But she twice hired an attorney who at the last minute bailed on her, and the one attorney, right as they were going to walk into the courtroom for a hearing, turned around and told her he couldn't represent her and walked away. And this is after they had taken thousands of dollars of this woman's money. And nobody thinks there's anything wrong with that either. But, you know, I liken that if you took your car to the shop, and your mechanic tore the car all down and then said, you know what, I don't have time to fix this, and walked off, you could sue him.
Yeah, you would have recourse against the mechanic, but with an attorney, it is very difficult. You know, and Dean, who was on a few weeks ago, I went through his file, and there was instance after instance of where the attorney did not file appropriate documents at the appropriate time. And, you know, this gets back to how the court system works, and it's all based on documents prepared properly and presented properly, or else, you know, that's the only information the judge has to go on. You know, I'm sure there are evil, corrupt judges, but before we accuse all of them of being on the take, you need to look at how the system works. The judge can only act on motions and petitions that are brought before the court. And in Dean's case, this attorney who was taking his money did not prepare the proper documents, did not file them in time, did not bring the case in front of the judge. And I had the very same problem myself initially with an attorney who I won't name, but his initials are Dennis Sandoval in Riverside, California. You know, he got us into the system and then did nothing. And so there you are. You show up at court. You're paying your attorney good money. You're expecting him to represent you and bring your case in and explain what's going on. And he does nothing. The other side is throwing accusations like crazy, and your own attorney is not objecting. He's not responding in any way. And you're helpless. If you, as a member of the audience in the court, stand up and try to speak, you'll likely be held in contempt and removed from the courtroom. You are totally at the mercy of your attorney. And you just better hope you have a good one. And if you don't, you fire them and you hope you can find a good one. But they are few and far between.
Well, if I ever have to go into court, I have had to a couple times over the years, but I always represent myself because I don't figure anybody can argue any better than I can. And I don't mean that facetiously. I just, you know, when you're fighting for yourself, you tend to be a little more tenacious. But what I have seen with these attorneys has been that in these cases, and just like in divorce, you know, you may think your attorney's fighting with you, but actually your attorney knows your ex's attorney or soon-to-be ex's attorney, and they're talking to each other, and they come to an agreement, and then they try to steer both of you towards it. But I've seen too many of these things that were obviously settled before it ever came into court between the attorneys and how they were going to handle it, which one was going to say what and who was going to do what. And then I worked as a paralegal for about 3 years. That was enough to turn your stomach. When you saw what actually went in, and it wasn't on issues dealing with anything like this, it was criminal. But when you saw how everything was rigged, if you go into the courtroom, it's a done deal. it's already done. You're just going through motions to come to a predetermined conclusion.
And that was what we saw, you know, when Brooke Ann Marks was on a few weeks ago. We went down and sat in on the sentencing hearing for, it was Nancy Totonis, was the director of the facility where Brooke's mom died. You know, just unbelievable elder abuse in that care facility. And the initial charges, there were seven felonies brought against this woman, the director of the facility. She was charged with seven felonies. By the time we got to the trial, it had been plea bargained down to two misdemeanors. She walked away with two misdemeanors. And that was all done behind closed doors, between the prosecutor and the defender. And, you know, so here Brooke shows up thinking that they're finally having their day in court. And, well, yes, the woman was found guilty, but she was found guilty of two misdemeanors. And in that case, the judge really spoke quite strongly that he did not feel that was adequate. But the deal had already been arranged before we even got into court, and there was nothing he could do. He sternly lectured this woman about the things she did, and we know about how much she would have paid attention to that lecture. I'm sure she'll go out and do whatever she wants. The judge was not in favor of what happened, but this is what was brought to him, and the judge can only act on what's brought to him.
It's just, I'm telling you, this is just, we've got to, and I don't know how we would even go about doing it, but we've got to regain control of our court system. And the first thing I think needs to be done is to get rid of administrative courts. As I explained to Dr. Fettgather when we spoke, in an administrative court, they're dealing with contract law. These courts are set up under U.S. Code and Title, which is the regulations and rules for operating a corporation by a contract. That's what U.S. Code and Title is. And these courts are set up as administrative courts, not courts of the common law or constitutional civil courts. Therefore, they're not subject to the Constitution or your rights. And one of the things in several of the cases that I have here at the house, people have sent me, I've seen in court documents where judges have told people who said, you know, I have rights under the Constitution. If you mention the Constitution in my court again, I'll put you in jail. And I thought, how the hell can they get away with that? Well, it's this differentiation between the courts. And in that administrative court, they only have to go by code and title. Or statute, state statute. They're not bound by the Constitution or common law. So they get, this is how they get away with a lot of what they do, like the dismissing of legal instruments, the throwing aside of wills written many years before, the liquidation of assets, everything. They're not bound by what you think they're bound by. So in order to regain control of our court system, to me, the first thing we have to do is get rid of the family courts, get rid of the probate courts, and any other sub-administrative court that's operating out there. There should not be any courts in this country except our state courts. And, of course, you know, your local judiciary, you know what I'm saying, that for local issues. But probate and family matters can't be part of that. These issues are too important to be handled by these people off the street with no legal background, no understanding of what they're doing, and many of them have not a clue what they're doing, and go back to our regular courts, to our state courts. If they are really that burdened with, you know, these dockets, then expand the state court. Don't create sub-courts that aren't subject to anybody's control or oversight. One of the things I think I brought up last week, Linda, and I keep tossing this around, is the entity responsible for what happens in these probate and family courts is the state court system. And it's them that we have to go after and put the pressure on to clean these courts up. Either close them down and put this back at the state court level, or get control of them, and it's got to start there. these courts are operating in such an egregious fashion. They're harming so many people, and it's being done for profit. It's not to care for anybody. It's not to look out for anyone. It's not to protect someone who might be vulnerable. That's not what they're doing.
And there are huge numbers of people making a living off of this system. You know, when I look at what has gone into my mother's case, we've averaged one hearing a month for, we're not quite at 3 years, about 2.5 years now. Now, about 2 years, we've had a hearing a month. I'm not sure how many times we've been to court, but, you know, sometimes two hearings a month, sometimes just one. But nothing ever gets decided. It just keeps getting pushed out and pushed out and pushed out. Now, if the court would just get its act together, hear the case, and make a decision, we wouldn't need to be clogging the system. You know, we're coming in month after month after month and doing nothing. And each time we come in, half a dozen attorneys line up in front of the bench, and each of them has some little something to say. And the judge says, well, now you all see if you can work this out. You know, you go and try to make a, come to an agreement on this. And, you know, we're going to come back in another month and report on it. And we've done this over and over. And in my mom's situation, I'm looking at this court-appointed attorney who opposes the family every step of the way, a court-appointed investigator who did not do an investigation.
Your call is...
Marty, have I lost you?
No, you haven't, Linda.
Okay.
I was trying to raise Dr. Fettgather, and I'm really becoming concerned that possibly something has... gone wrong here, because he was really looking forward to being here this evening and had sent me quite a bit of material.
He's a very responsible person. I do have some concerns. I know he was driving up to Sacramento this weekend, and I do hope he got back okay.
Yeah. I'm just, you know, it just worries me because he was really planning on this, and so was I, as a matter of fact, especially after speaking with him. Yeah, I don't know. I keep trying to rack my brain, Linda, of what we can do, something positive that we can do to move people forward out of this. One of the things that you know, has been brought up to me repeatedly, and it's hard for me because I personally have not been involved in one of these, but the frustration.
Well, you saw it next door.
Yeah.
You were close enough to get to see what it smells like.
Yeah, and it's ugly. And I can't imagine having to deal with this every single day, having to battle this, you know, on a continuing basis. And it would be different if you stood a chance, you know, if there was any sense of fairness to the system or if it was handled appropriately. But it's so rare that it is. Here a couple years ago, a close friend of mine, her father passed away, and he was quite a wealthy man. And he, of course, had everything all set up, and, you know, he had three children, who was to get what, and immediately each of them inherited $250,000 cash. But the remainder of the estate was quite sizable, and because he had everything set up, the family attorney said there's no need for probate. You know, we simply need to end all of this and divvy up the assets. They had an attorney walk in and waiving a petition to the court, allowing him to take conservatorship and make sure that everything was handled appropriately. And they had to fight and argue with this man. And finally, the judge, before they left this day, said to the daughter who was the executrix of the will, and, you know, it was all signed and ready to go, said to her, you, and pointed to this attorney who had intervened, said, each of you write me a letter and tell me why you should be conservator of this estate. And my girlfriend turned around and looked at me like, what? So when we walked outside the courtroom, her sister was crying. She said, what did they do this for? I said, they're after the money. And she says, what do I put in the letter? I said, just put down there I should be the executrix. and the conservator of this estate because my father appointed me to do so. And I am his daughter. And she just wrote that down on a piece of paper, handed it back to the judge. As it ended up, he went with her, went ahead and let her administer the estate. And, of course, she distributed everything to the heirs like she was supposed to. But that was my first encounter with this. In fact, prior to that, a friend of mine in New York, John Wallace, who has a radio show there, had sent me Sarah Harvey's information, and he said, would you consider interviewing this woman? And kind of explained to me what was happening there, and I thought, boy, I don't know if I want to get into that, you know, because I don't know anything about it. And it was between that email and my first show, which was with Sarah, that this instance in this courtroom happened. And
that family
realized,
was very fortunate.
Yeah.
I think there's this huge fallacy. People think that because they have put wills and trusts and powers of attorney into place, they think they are protected. And, you know, I certainly do those things anyway. Richard and I were just discussing the plans that we should perhaps be updating for ourselves, because if you don't have the power of attorney, well, we were talking about his recent car crash, you know, who he would want to be responsible for what aspects of his life, who he would want to make decisions for the different things, and how we would best arrange that ahead of time. But now we also, after seeing my mother's situation, understand that no matter what either one of us puts in place, there is a possibility that someone will override that. You know, we certainly don't want to go into a situation of becoming disabled without having those instruments in place, because that pretty much guarantees that the public guardian is going to take over. But even if we do have everything perfectly set up, you know, my mother's affairs were set up. Many other people I talk to, they have everything in place, spend thousands of dollars to have attorneys prepare all of the appropriate documents, and it's all turned over in a blink of an eye. You know, everything with just a couple of signatures is undone.
Well, exactly. And you know, I've mentioned this on several shows, and I'm going to mention it again. Right here in the area where I live, out here in the middle of central Minnesota in the dairy cows and cornfields, we have a band of attorneys operating, and they're putting out flyers and ads in the papers and direct mailers and, you know, avoid conservatorship and guardianship, you know, plan your estate, come to our estate planning event, and we'll show you how to protect yourself and your heirs. And before you go into one of these special meetings, you have to sit down and fill out a form telling what assets you have, how much they're worth, where they're located, who else's names might be on them, what the total value of your net worth might be, what was on your taxes last year. That's so you can get in and get the free meal.
Mm-hmm.
And people have said to me, well, do you think that's a good idea? No.
No.
They're databasing. No, I don't think it's a good idea. Don't tell anybody what you've got. When you go into the hospital now, and they tell you, you know, they've got people laying on gurneys, gushing blood from every orifice of their body. Sign this paper for your insurance. The other thing you're signing when you put your signature on that paper is an agreement to let them do an asset search on you. And that's done immediately before you get any care of any kind. An asset search is done on you to see if you can pay the bill. And also to flag whoever they might be working with.
Exactly.
That somebody with a lot of assets has just come in and they're vulnerable. And we saw this at St. Cloud Hospital. They would come in, they'd do this asset search thing, and overnight they had a guardian. By 8 o'clock the next morning, they were under the control of a predatory guardian.
Now, the minute people get information on your accounts, it's no longer safe. You know, in my mother's case, in that first week after she was abducted, I think it was 4 days before they got all of her bank accounts closed down and assets moved. And in the conservatorship petition, they explained that this was necessary because they didn't know who might have access to those accounts. Translation of that is my name was also on those accounts.
Oh.
That's who had access to the accounts. I did. My name was on them. My mother gave me a checkbook. That's who else had access to the accounts, and they needed those accounts closed and the assets moved before I got wind of what happened and went in and locked everything down.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was June 5th was the date my mom was taken from her home. By June 9th, all the assets were transferred to where they were no longer in my name. And one account was in the name of another person who's very close to my mom. That account was also closed.
I just, you know, this that makes me think, Linda, up there in, I believe it's Washington, is the Dorothy Griega case. And Dorothy Griega has been dead now, I believe, 4 years, maybe only three, but I think four. And before this lady died, she had several charitable trusts set up. And Bank of America was involved, along with, I believe, Wells Fargo. And they began immediately draining, once they took this guardianship, draining her accounts and moving her assets from one bank to the other. Because some of these accounts were in charitable trusts, they simply went to the other bank and opened up a bogus charitable trust with a phony EIN number on it, or a TIN number on it, and funneled the money into there and started draining it out that way. And this got reported to the IRS that this was a front and that the TIN number provided was false. And the investigator working on that said to me, she said, wouldn't you think the IRS would know that number was phony? I said, of course they knew. Of course they did. They knew this before you did. And yet they did nothing about it and still have not. Now, like I say, that lady has passed away at least 3 years ago. They are still tapping what remains of her estate. And they are filing documents, the audit documents with the court. And they are tapping that estate for thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars a month to benefit the ward who has been dead for 3 years.
And for management of the estate, I'm sure. There are always fees for management of the estate.
Yeah, but these papers read, Linda, to benefit the ward. I don't know what she did. She must be in a really special place and need a lot of things because she's still paying for them. But I see this stuff all over the country, and and some of this stuff, when you hear it, you think, this can't be true. This cannot possibly be true. And then you see the court documents and you find out not only is it true, it's worse than you thought it was.
Oh, I would not have believed this before it happened to me. I would have thought anyone who said things like this was crazy.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It seemed absolutely impossible. Well, you know, I came from a fairly rarefied atmosphere. I went to grad school at Berkeley. We talked about civil liberties and social justice. And, you know, I had a fairly rosy picture of the world coming out of the Berkeley environment. And then my mother's front door was kicked in and she was taken away and locked up like a rabid dog. My worldview changed very rapidly.
You know, there's a fellow in Colorado named Jay Bush. And his mother, he has the 911 tape of his mother calling 911 and screaming, help, 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 somebody's breaking in. Who was breaking in? The police and Adult Protective Services. And they slammed this woman into a wall. She was 80-some years old and handcuffed her and took her out of her house that way. And out in Colorado, they have an Adult Protective Services statute out there that if you're over the age of 60, they can do a wellness check at any given time for little to no reason. And they can come to your door, and if you refuse to let them in to make sure you're well, they can kick your door in and put you in for observation for at least 72 hours, from which I can guarantee you, you will never emerge. Apparently, being over 60, which would catch me, is a hazard now.
Yeah, I'm only 5 years away from it.
Yeah. It's actually become hazardous to age in this country. And especially if you've got anything, and just for anybody who might be listening, I got nothing, absolutely nothing. Even
yeah,
my dog
I would,
is
a, I would. It is certainly hazardous to age with any assets.
Yes.
But that includes owning a home. If you own a home, that is a valuable asset, and most older folks have their homes paid for, and that can be turned into a fair amount of cash in most places, and that makes, even if someone is living a very modest lifestyle, you know, eking out a meager existence on Social Security, if they have a home, they are a target. You're valuable.
Yes.
And what Dr. Bob was going to talk about tonight was the federal funding that comes to disabled adults makes them very attractive targets. I had no idea about that aspect of the guardianship system until I first spoke with him a couple of weeks ago. And I just couldn't get my head around why his son was of such great interest to the guardian system. I mean, here's this young man who doesn't have a job, has no income that I would be aware of, seems to have no means. I mean, he has Down syndrome. He's never going to earn a living. And so initially I thought perhaps he had an inheritance or a trust. And then Dr. Bob explained that disabled adults receive over $100,000 a year in federal money.
As long as they're in an institution.
And, well, that's where his son is now.
And if you had that same disabled adult at home, you might be able to get Social Security disability for them and some state aid. You would
if
be able
lucky.
To get that.
Yeah, I know another family has a daughter who is autistic. She is somewhat functional but certainly limited and needs assistance. And they have been fighting the county for years trying to get just a modest amount of assistance for their daughter so that she can remain living independently and not have to go into an institution. And it is just an unbelievable battle what they are going through. And the mother actually works in the disabilities field, and the father is a physician. You know, these are not people who wouldn't be able to take on the system, you would think, but they're having an amazingly difficult time getting assistance for their daughter, who really just needs a bit of help to stay independent. But
well,
in Dr. Bob's case, you know, the son has Down syndrome. I think he said his son's IQ is around 55, clearly needs help. Scooped up, placed in an institution, locked down, you know, allowed meager visitation whenever they happen to feel like it. And that's just so typical of what's done with the elders. You know, they're taken from their homes, accusations made against family. I still get a chuckle, or in years coming I will get a chuckle, and now I occasionally get a chuckle. In different sets of documents, I've been accused of intimidating my mother, threatening her, forcing her to give me money, but in the same time period, I am also accused of being estranged from her and having no contact. That's my response.
Well, you are a purely
shall we flip
magical
a coin?
Person, girl.
Somehow, in the 22 years while I was estranged from my mother and had no contact with her, I was also threatening her and intimidating her into giving me money.
Oh, my God. I...
And when we took the deposition of the step-granddaughter, who now controls my mother, my attorney asked if she had any evidence of my taking money from my mother. And the step-granddaughter responded that, well, she's seen the checks that my mother wrote to me. And he asked, you know, roughly when those checks were written. And it seems that every year there was a check written in late December, and there was another check written in mid-July, which is when my birthday is. And so the attorney says, well, now are you really certain that, you know, Linda forced her mother to give her this money? Or was it possible that these were Christmas gifts and birthday gifts? And the step-granddaughter acknowledged, well, it might have been gifts. And I think that's what most
you
of
think?
Us would have... Yeah, most of us, if we saw checks from a parent to a child, in late December and around the birthday, most of us would assume it was a gift.
Yes, yes. I always felt
a bit odd that my mother was sending me money when I was in my 40s, but most of us probably know moms who do these sorts of things.
Yeah.
You know,
well, I do.
I mean, yes, I mean, every birthday, every Christmas, my mother sent me a check for $200, and I would be embarrassed. But, you know, this was something that she wanted to do, and it was better to just say thank you and take the check.
Exactly.
And now it's been turned into these, you know, years upon years upon years when I was extorting money from my mother.
Oh, my goodness. $200 at a time.
Yes, year after year after year. Yes, so be careful what you take from your mother.
Yes, I'm just... But you talk about these kids and their value, these vulnerable young adults, like with Dr. Fettgather's son. And you talk about them, you know, and their value in the system and being worth, you know, over $100,000 a year. The reason that is because once they're in the system, they now they can get disability for them, and they get state aid, and they get federal aid, and there's various programs through the federal government that they can tap into, and they get money for that, and then the agency who placed them gets a little bonus check for that. And now you can have a doctor claim that they saw them 10 times a week when they really didn't, and you can pad the bill on that. And like I say, they can be leased out now, and basically this is what it amounts to. They can be leased out to pharmaceutical companies for the testing of vaccines, for the testing of psychotropic drugs, various things they're working on. You can't do a damn thing about it. We saw this happen down in Florida and Alaska, where the two worst states, but it was happening across the country, and where the kids in foster care, this is what they were doing to children in foster care, being wards of the state. They had no rights. They weren't recognized as even living under the law. And so they were leasing them out. And so these, when they come into these institutions, once they're institutionalized, the reason they hang on to them, you know, like sudden death, is because they can make money off of them from multiple sources, and it just never stops rolling in. With the protective agency, or what is supposed to be the protective agency, they work on a quota system, and it's kind of a case of job protection. They have to handle X number of these cases in, let's say, a month's period. They have to have so many on the books. In order to keep their job,
yeah,
they're expected
their existence.
To do this. And this also qualifies them for more state and federal funds. And so they, a lot of times, will pack the system and bring more in than what actually needs to be in to make it look like, you know, I'm just overworked and we need more help, we need more money. And like I say, it's job protection. But yeah, there is so much available that's written into legislation that comes from the federal. There's grant money, there's subsidies, there's program funds, there's this, that, and something else. But none of this is available to that same vulnerable, disabled adult if they're living at home.
Yeah, if they're with their family, with people who care about them and are doing everything they can to take care of them. Yeah, this brings to mind something that Chris Murphy and I have been chatting about. You've had Chris on a couple of times. She's co-director of a nonprofit, CAR, which focuses on residential care facilities for the elderly. And at this point in time, these, they're better known as assisted living facilities, are all private pay. You know, if you want to go into assisted living, you have to somehow subsidize it on your own, or your family has to. Chris has made me aware of a new program coming along which will allow some of these facilities to tap into federal money. And she sent me some lists of facilities that have applied for this opportunity. And, you know, I'm not I'm not familiar with the details. We should probably get Chris on at some point to give us a better discussion of this. But my understanding is, you know, there are these facilities that are in the process right now of applying to be able to get federal money for care and assisted living, which on the surface you might say, well, this sounds great. That means these people who can't stay in their homes for whatever reason could have some assistance going into assisted living facilities. Until you see how horribly run some of these places are, and Chris sent me the four facilities in San Bernardino County that are applying for the federal money. And I grew up in that area, so I sort of know the landscape, and that's where my mom is right now. And one of them is in Yucaipa, which I've politely described as a hind end of nowhere, and when I'm not in a polite mood, I have far more colorful language to use for Yucaipa. It's mostly trailer parks and residential care facilities, and I will let you draw your own conclusions about the landscape.
Yeah.
Right down the road, there's another one in Mentone, which is about the same as Yucaipa. And then up the hill, there are two of these facilities in Hesperia, which is sort of a dusty truck stop before you hit the Mojave Desert. You know, these are not facilities that are in the nice parts of town where someone might actually want to be. These are facilities that are in very undesirable locations. And one of them was a facility that I've actually been inside. I was there when I was looking for a place where I could hopefully move my mom out of the place where she is now. And it was just creepy. The buildings were, they looked like they had been low-budget apartments or maybe condos at one point in time, and then they had been converted into this care facility. And the kitchen areas were still there, but with the plumbing disconnected, carpets, drapes were threadbare, furniture worn, bedding on the beds was mismatched, and you could practically see through it. You know, I suppose in a low-budget situation, you do what you need to do to care for someone, but this was not a place that I would find at all desirable, and I just couldn't get out of there fast enough and said, there's no way my mom's going in a place like this. You know, this looks even worse than where she is now. But they're applying for federal money.
What I'm trying to figure out is this. Keeping someone in their home is far less expensive. And I think I already know the answer to my observation.
And it's better
far
for
less expensive. Yeah, and far better for the individual than taking them out of everything they know and sticking them in one of these impersonal facilities where they're likely going to be neglected and abused. And so when they talk about costs, see, they never talk about all this hidden funding. They never talk about this pay-to-play system. You know, the more you get in here, the more money we'll give you. They never talk about any of that. They talk about, oh, it costs X amount of dollars to keep someone, if you have to provide care for them 24/7, you know, that can cost $4,000 or $5,000 a month. Well, putting them in one of these facilities can cost $6,000 or more.
Well,
but hey,
what?
Here in Minnesota, thanks to Pawlenty, when he was governor, every person that's in a nursing home or any kind of a state-sponsored assisted living facility that gets Social Security, $150 right off the top, comes out of their monthly benefit and goes right into the state coffers because they were put into that home. And that's every month of the year this happens. So it's money that they just take from these people, and many of them have been removed from their homes. And, Linda, I'm not disputing the fact that there are people who do need intensive care. They do need to be, it could be dementia, Alzheimer's. It could be that physically they're not able to take care of themselves anymore. There are always going to be those cases, but those are not occurring at as high a rate as they would like us to believe they are. Most of these people that they're doing this to are functioning well, able to take care of themselves, in good shape, till they get a hold of them. And
well,
then
you
everything
just
deteriorates.
Presented you know, assisted living and 24-hour care as an either-or situation. My mother has both. My mother is in an assisted living facility at the highest level of care, plus she has 24-hour caregivers because the facility decided that they were not able to meet her needs. Now, under state regulations, if they cannot meet the needs of a resident, they are supposed to require that resident be moved to a different facility that can provide the level of care that's needed. But in my mother's case, what they did was say, well, she's so difficult, we really can't manage her on our own. And so they told the conservator, who's the one paying the bill, that she has to provide 24-hour private caregivers. So the facility is getting, I think it's $5,100 a month for my mother's care, plus the senior home caregivers out of Redlands, California, is getting, I think it's about $7,000 for 24-hour private caregivers. And if that's not enough, my mother is also on hospice, has been for a year and a half, and that is being paid for by Medicare at about $5,000 a month. And this is all care going to one little old lady who does not have any substantial medical issues. She just needs help with her activities of daily living.
Jeez.
You know, my mother's not in intensive care. She's not on oxygen. Mm-hmm. She doesn't have IVs. You know, she's not hooked up to tubes. She's just a lady who needs some help with bathing, dressing. She needs sometimes needs some help with eating. And she's not able to walk, so she, at this point, well, she could walk when she went in there. She is no longer able to walk after being there. So she does need to be pushed around in her wheelchair to go from place to place. And that warrants the highest level of care, plus 24-hour-a-day caregivers, plus hospice. And no, she is not terminal.
And see, and I'm still this hospice thing. This is, and then you sent me that information, too, about them being owned by, who is it?
Yeah, Richard corrected me on that. They are not owned by Roto-Rooter. VITAS, Hospice, and Roto-Rooter are owned by the same company. They're owned by the same parent company. And originally, the only subsidiary was Roto-Rooter, and then they also acquired VITAS Hospice. So we're not talking a big conglomerate that owns many things, like many 7-Elevens and Super K's and whatever. This parent company initially owned Roto-Rooter and then also acquired VITAS Hospice.
I just
clean your drains and then clean your estate.
Yeah, it's about the same thing. And that's, I'm trying to figure out how hospice and when it became part of this predatory system, because 10 years ago, if hospice showed up, you were terminal, and they performed a very valuable and necessary service, and that was breaking the family so they could get away for a while and just refresh themselves, and they spent time with terminal patients, especially if they had no family or no one that seemed to care. They would spend time with them, visit with them. If they were able to, you know, move around at all, they might take them out. You know, but they were basically there to make sure that person did not meet their end of time alone.
And also to let them stay in their home. My stepdad, when he died, was on hospice. And that was so that he was able to stay in his home. You know, my mom cared for my stepdad as he died, kept him at home. That's where he wanted to be. And hospice came in to help with some of the chores that needed to be done so that my mother was able to keep him there, you know, so that he did not have to go into a facility. And that was a very valuable service. Unfortunately, Medicare pays for hospice without providing much oversight of what's being done. And as long as you dummy up documents that satisfy the regulations, you can pretty much do what you want. In my mother's case, I finally, through subpoenas, got the records from the hospice agency, VITAS, It's Vitas Innovative Hospice Services out of, I think they're also in Redlands. They might be San Bernardino. They're in San Bernardino County. My mother was placed on hospice for losing 22 pounds over 6 months, and if that continued, she was expected to die within an additional 6 months. So this 22-pound weight loss was the terminal condition that allowed her to be placed on hospice. However, if you look at her medical records for the same period of time, she was actually gaining weight.
Really?
Really. My mother did have a 20-pound weight loss a couple of years earlier that was related to a lung infection that was not diagnosed for some time.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they were testing everything, couldn't figure out why she was losing weight. It was just going, you know, she was going down, 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 down. She got down to about 90 pounds. Then they diagnosed the lung condition, started treating it, and she started slowly gaining weight. By the time she was placed on hospice, she was back up from 90 to about 100 pounds. So she had actually gained weight in those intervening months before she was placed on hospice. But
it sounds to me like that was a plan in action. I'm sorry, but it does.
And there are multiple, and I reported this to, I believe it's OIG, office, and I'm not sure what that stands for, but it's the federal agency where you report Medicare fraud. They went in and audited the facility's records and said, well, all of their documents are in order. Their documents show that she had a 22-pound weight loss, and that qualifies her for hospice, and so everything is okay. It's not Medicare fraud. And I said, well, but what about these medical records I showed you where it shows she did not lose the weight? It's, oh, well, we can't take into consideration outside documents.
What?
So, again, very easy. You dummy up whatever documents you need to satisfy the regulations, push it on through, and chances are you'll get away with it.
My God. Something I wanted to touch on here, Linda. Your partner there had come across a website on how to steal an estate. And I cannot believe that something like this exists. But it does. And I think it's just an indicator of how sick a certain portion of our population is, that something like this could exist even on the net.
I think it was meant facetiously, and I've actually half considered making up my own website on how to make a million without even trying. You know, just go find a little old lady, kick in her door, and lock her up. But,
yeah.
You know, the bottom line is that website is pretty much correct. That's how you go about it. And it's such common knowledge that pretty much anyone can give you an outline of how to do it. And if you are so inclined, you can go do it. Just as my mother's step-granddaughter did.
Oh, my God. How did she get, I don't understand, she's not actually, you know, a blood relative. And, you know, how did she accomplish this?
She got my mother to sign a package of documents, one of which was an advanced health care directive, which nominated her to be conservator should my mother need one. Then she promptly took that and went to court, filed a petition for conservatorship, saying, here, my grandma nominated me to be her conservator, and so I'm here to do my job.
Oh, my God.
At the same time, accusing me of intimidating, abusing, stealing from my mother, all the while I was estranged and had no contact.
Ah.
And those documents will stand. Those documents were signed 5 days after my mother's door was broken in. My mom was taken out June 5th. On June 9th, all of the bank accounts were closed and transferred into an account with Mindy. I'm not supposed to say her name on the air, so please forget I said that. Then on June 10th, my mom signed all of these documents, will, trust, power of attorney, advanced health care directive, in favor of the step-granddaughter.
Oh, my.
All accomplished in 5 days. So in a matter of 5 days, my mother's life was totally taken over.
This is so disgusting.
It does need to be done quickly, because if I had known what was going on, I would have locked down those accounts. I would have called up the banks and said, freeze those things. Don't give the money to anybody.
Right.
You know, don't give it to me if you think it's me coming in there. Just lock it down and don't give it to anybody. You know, I would have scooped up my mother and got her out of the county. But if it can be done quickly before the family realizes what happens, it's a done deal. Those documents are in the court record, and then the family has to contest those documents and in years get them overturned if they can. But by then, the elder is generally deceased.
That's just... these things just... The idea that any of this could be happening and that nothing is done to stop it, that's what I can't... I think, Linda, you know, underneath everything, this has been brought in front of these courts so many times. And the just with the cases I have laying here, I have 152 of them.
Wow.
That people have sent me. And to look at this, I can't find a judge in there that isn't corrupt. I can't find an attorney that isn't a predator. I can't find a guardian, one of these strangers to the family, that isn't in it just to steal the estate. I can't find one case in just what I have in my possession where the guardian actually has ever acted to protect that vulnerable elderly person. I cannot find one instance where Adult Protective Services acted to protect that elderly person. In fact, most people around here, you mentioned Adult Protective Services, they head for the hills. They don't want anything to do with them. And so when I look at this and I figure I have just this little smattering of cases, 152 out of how many tens of thousands where this is going on, I cannot find one individual charged with protecting these people, acting in an official capacity or in the capacity of an attorney, guardian, whatever, that isn't abusing these people, that isn't breaking the law. And so this is what I say. We've got to start with getting rid of these courts, because this is basically how all this is facilitated. Without these probate courts, this couldn't happen. And I've said before, we've only got a minute and a half left here, but as I've said before, the only way a probate court can come into play is on production of a death certificate. This is why declaring guardianship declares you dead in the law. It's the only way the probate court can be activated, is you have to produce a death certificate. And guardianship is, in effect, a legal death. We have got just about a minute left here. I'm going to be back on tomorrow night with Yoda from Magnified View again, and we had him on this last week, and he just blew everybody's socks off. We'll be talking about Homeland Security, what is happening there. Linda, thank you so much for coming on tonight to co-host with me, and I hope we hear from Dr. Fettgather. I'm really concerned.
Yeah, I'll check in and be sure he's okay. And next week
do.
We have a couple of really interesting folks talking about the same thing going on in Washington, D.C.
Excellent, excellent. So everybody join us next Sunday evening, 7 Central. Linda will be back as co-host for the show. And Linda, again, thank you for setting all of this up and lining these people up. I have to give her credit. She's done all of this. So we'll be back. Talk to you next week. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. And good night.
See you next week. Bye-bye.